We all want to be in the know, right? Like, understand what's really going on in the world around us, especially right here in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena.
Yeah, definitely. But it's easy to get overwhelmed. Information overload is a real thing these days.
Totally. That's why we do these deep dives. We cut through all the noise to find those key ideas that really matter. Today, we're looking at something pretty fascinating. It's about prices.
Okay, prices, yeah, like how much things cost.
Exactly. But it's more than just like, oh, supply and demand, you know.
Right. There's got to be more to it.
We're going deep with this guy, Ludwig von Mises. He wrote this book called Human Action, and it's got some really insightful stuff about prices and how they work in a market.
So we're going to try to figure out what really sets prices, right?
Exactly. We might even bust some myths along the way. Like, you know how sometimes people think, oh, that price is high, they must be ripping people off.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Well, Mises has some interesting thoughts about that. Let's get into it.
Okay, let's dive in.
So when you think about prices, here in our local area, like at the stores in Deer Park or the shops down in Pasadena, what comes to mind?
I mean, I guess, like you said, the basics, right? If there's a lot of something and people don't want it that much, it'll be cheaper.
Yeah, that's the classic supply and demand.
But Mises says it's deeper than that.
He does. He brings in things like how much people trust a seller, or even like the reputation a business has built up over time.
Ah, okay, that makes sense. Like, if you know a place is good, you might be willing to pay a bit more.
Exactly. He calls this goodwill, which sounds kind of old school, but it's a powerful idea.
So how does goodwill actually work in like economics?
Well, think of it this way. It's like that local bakery in Pasadena, the one everyone loves.
Yeah, I know the one.
They've been around forever, and people trust them. They know they'll get a good cake there, even if it costs a bit more than the supermarket.
Right, it's that feeling of like knowing what you're gonna get.
Exactly. And that's their goodwill. It's an asset, almost like a valuable piece of equipment they own.
Interesting. But that goodwill, it's based on how people feel, right? Not always hard
You
facts.
got it. It's all about perception.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have two products that are basically the same, but one has a fancy brand name and a higher price tag.
Yeah, and people still go for the brand name.
They do. It's because they're basically saying, I trust this company. I'm willing to pay a little extra for that peace of mind.
So they're choosing trust over like perfectly knowing everything about the product.
Right. Now, Mises talks about government labeling as a possible alternative, you know, like if the government inspected everything and gave it a quality stamp.
You can see that. But does Mises like that idea?
He's not a fan. He thinks relying on government to be the judge of quality, well, it's a bit risky. You're putting a lot of faith in those officials.
Yeah, I guess they could make mistakes or even be biased, right?
Exactly. Plus, Mises is big on individual choice. He thinks even if people choose a brand that seems illogical to others, it's their decision to make.
Okay, so freedom to choose, even when it comes to shopping, makes sense.
It does. But let's be real, building that goodwill, it's hard work, right? Any business owner in Deer Park can tell you that.
Yeah, for sure. It's not like you open your doors and boom, everyone trusts you.
Nope. It takes time, consistency, often some initial sacrifices, like maybe you offer lower prices at first or go above and beyond with customer service.
You're investing in that goodwill.
You got it. Now, Mises lays out three different ways this goodwill plays out in the market.
Okay, let's hear them. What's the first one?
In the first case, goodwill can actually give a seller some real power. They might be able to charge higher prices, kind of like a monopoly.
Ha, so their reputation becomes so strong, they've got more wiggle room with pricing?
Yeah, exactly. They're not just competing on price anymore. They've got something extra.
Interesting. What about the second case?
The second one is kind of the flip side. Here, goodwill isn't about charging more. It's about surviving.
What do you mean?
It's like, imagine a new store opens up right here in LaPorte. They don't have any goodwill yet, right? So they might have to charge lower prices just to get people in the door.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that. They need to build that trust.
They do. Otherwise, they might not be able to compete with the established businesses.
Makes sense. So goodwill can be a real make or break thing for a business.
It can be. Now, the third case is pretty interesting, too. In this one, a seller with strong goodwill might charge higher prices, but not because they're being greedy.
So it's not like a deliberate choice to rip people off?
Not at all. It's more about the market itself. Think of that really popular doctor everyone wants to see, even if their fees are higher.
Yeah, I've heard of doctors with waiting lists, even if they're expensive.
It's not that the doctor is purposely limiting their appointments to drive up the price. It's just they're operating at capacity and demand is high.
Ah, so they're not artificially restricting anything, it's just how things are.
Right. Mises says sometimes a business might not expand, even if they could charge more, because maybe they don't have the resources, or they think that money could be better spent elsewhere.
Okay, that makes sense. They're thinking strategically.
They are. And this leads us to a really important distinction Mises makes between a monopoly and, well, just regular competition.
Right, because monopoly is a word people throw around a lot, sometimes without really knowing what it means.
It is. So for Mises, monopoly prices happen when someone deliberately limits the supply of something just to jack up the price.
Oh, okay, so it's intentional. Like they could make more of the product, but they choose not to.
Precisely. They're basically saying, I'm going to make less, charge more, and make more profit that way.
Sounds kind of shady.
It can be. And it goes against what consumers actually want. Now, with regular competition, the opposite happens. Businesses try to make as much as people will buy, and they compete on things like quality and efficiency.
So, in a competitive market, making more profit means making customers happier.
Exactly. You're making their lives better, and they reward you for it. Whereas with a monopoly, you're making a profit by, well, kind of making life a bit worse for people.
That's a big difference. Now, Mises also talks about this thing called a monopoly of demand. What's that all about?
It's kind of like the flip side of a regular monopoly. Instead of one seller controlling the supply, it's one buyer controlling the demand.
Oh, so like if there was only one person in all of Deer Park who wanted to buy a certain thing.
That's the idea. But Mises argues that this monopoly of demand doesn't really give the buyer the same kind of power that a regular monopoly gives a seller.
Why not? I mean, if they're the only customer, wouldn't the seller have to give them a great deal?
Maybe, but they'd also probably only buy a small amount. Mises uses the example of a government banning exports to keep prices low for domestic consumers.
So, like, if the U.S. banned wheat exports, the price of bread here might go down, but farmers would also sell less overall.
Exactly. It's not a true monopoly in the same sense as a company deliberately limiting production. And Mises argues that a lot of what people call a monopoly of demand actually boils down to a monopoly of supply somewhere else in the chain.
Okay, explain that one.
Imagine there's this one company that makes a special part that's used in all smartphones.
Okay, so lots of phone companies need that part.
Right. And on the surface, it looks like those phone companies have all the power because they're the ones demanding the part.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But because that one company controls the supply of the part, they actually have the real power.
Ah, it's like a hidden
You
monopoly.
got it. It's all about where the bottleneck is. So let's bring this back to us here in Southeast Houston. How do these monopoly prices actually affect our lives?
Well, if a company has a monopoly and raises prices, people here in Pasadena will react in different ways. Some folks might just grit their teeth and pay the extra.
Yeah, maybe they cut back on something else in their budget.
Right. Others might buy less of that product to keep their spending the same. And some people might just say, forget it and find something else entirely.
It all depends on how essential the product is and how much people are willing to adjust their spending habit.
Exactly. But no matter what, when prices go up like that, it usually means less satisfaction for consumers. They're not getting what they want at the price they want it.
They're getting squeezed. Now, Mises does point out one big exception to this whole monopoly problem: patents and copyrights.
Oh, yeah, those are interesting. So with a patent, the inventor basically gets a temporary monopoly, right?
They do. And the argument is it's a necessary evil. You need to give creators and inventors that incentive to, put in the time and effort to come up with new things.
So we accept higher prices for a while because ultimately it benefits everyone.
That's the idea. It's a trade-off between short-term affordability and long-term progress.
Makes sense. You know, Mises also talks about this tricky issue of like non-renewable resources, like oil and gas, things that are finite.
Yeah, he points out how people often complain about high oil prices, but those high prices can actually be a good thing in a way.
How so?
Well, if prices are high, it means people are more likely to conserve, right? And that stretches out the supply.
Ah, so it slows down the rate of depletion.
Exactly. Which could be good for future generations, even if it means paying more today. Now, let's talk about something we see all the time: price discrimination.
Oh, yeah, like when seniors get discounts or there are early bird specials.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
But Mises focuses on what he calls genuine price discrimination, which is when a seller charges different prices for the exact same thing, based purely on what they think each buyer is willing to pay.
So it's not about getting a different product or service. It's just about charging different people different amounts.
Right. And for this to work, there are a couple of conditions that have to be met. First, the seller has to be able to stop people from buying at the low price and then reselling at the high price.
Otherwise, everyone would just buy at the low price. Makes sense. What's the second condition?
The seller has to make more money overall by doing this price discrimination than they would by just charging everyone the same price.
Obviously, yeah. Why bother with the hassle if it doesn't boost your profits?
Exactly. And Mises makes an interesting point. He says the cost of making the product doesn't really matter when deciding whether to price discriminate.
Really? How come?
Well, as long as you're making the same amount of the product, the cost is already set. It's more about figuring out how to maximize your revenue from those units.
I see. He uses the example of a doctor charging rich patients more and poorer patients less.
Right. It's a way for the doctor to increase their income and potentially help out folks who couldn't afford their regular fees.
So it can actually be beneficial for some buyers.
It can be. Of course, not everyone likes price discrimination, but it's a strategy that's out there.
For sure. And, you know, he also talks about the opposite, price discrimination by buyers.
Yeah, that's when the buyer has the power to set different prices for sellers.
Sounds tricky.
It is. Mises says it usually only happens when the sellers are really in the dark about market prices or when the government is meddling. He gives the example of a government-controlled cereal company in Switzerland that was buying wheat from farmers at different prices.
Okay, so not exactly a free market situation.
Not at all. Now let's move on to something really crucial. The fact that all these prices are connected, Mises calls this the connexity of prices.
So it's like the price of milk in Pasadena isn't just some random number, it's influenced by other prices.
Absolutely. Mises talks about a few different types of connection. First, there's connexity of production. That's when making one thing also results in making something else.
Okay, so like when you mill lumber, you also get sawdust.
Perfect example. And the demand for lumber affects the supply and price of sawdust, even though it's kind of a byproduct. Then there's connexity of consumption.
Is that like things that get used together?
Yeah, like cars and gasoline. If the price of gas goes way up, the demand for gas-guzzling cars might go down.
Makes sense. What's the third type?
That's connexity of substitution, where you have things that compete with each other. Like, imagine two gas stations here in La Porte.
Yeah, if one raises prices too much, people will just go to the other one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But beyond these specific connections, Mises says there's a general connexity that links all prices together.
Okay, what's the common thread there?
It's labor. Because almost every product or service requires labor to produce it, changes in wages will ripple through the whole economy.
Ah, so if construction workers in Deer Park get a raise, it might eventually affect the price of groceries in Pasadena.
It could. It all gets interconnected. And remember, every price is just a snapshot of what individuals value at a particular moment.
It's dynamic, constantly changing.
It is. Now let's shift gears a bit and talk about how prices relate to income and overall production.
All right, sounds good.
So Mises makes a key distinction. Market prices are the result of individual transactions. They're not set by some grand plan or some average price level.
They're based on what real buyers and sellers are doing right now.
Exactly. And he emphasizes that the market itself doesn't create income.
That's interesting. So where does income come from then?
It comes from the smart use and preservation of resources, things like land, labor, and capital. You know, the things we use to produce goods and services.
Okay, so if we take care of those resources and use them well, they'll generate income over time.
That's the idea. But of course, the market can change, and that can affect income streams.
Right. There's always risk involved.
There is. And Mises stresses that pricing isn't about distribution. It's about guiding production.
What do you mean by that?
It means prices tell businesses what to make and how much to make based on what people are willing to pay.
Ah, so it's a signal to producers.
It is. It tells them where to focus their efforts. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes you have resources that aren't being used, like a factory that's idle.
Does Mises think that's always a bad thing?
Not necessarily. Sometimes it just means technology has moved on or demand has shifted. Trying to artificially prop up inefficient production is usually a waste.
Okay, so like forcing farmers in Southeast Houston to grow bananas when the climate isn't right would be silly.
Exactly. Mises uses the example of international trade, like trading Swiss watches for Canadian wheat, to show that specialization and exchange are the most efficient ways to get what we want.
It's about playing to your strengths, right?
It is. Now, Mises gets pretty fired up about this idea of non-market prices.
What does he mean by that?
He means prices that are set by something other than the free market, like if the government tried to dictate how much bread should cost.
I see. He's saying that's not how prices really work.
Exactly. Prices are a natural outcome of supply and demand. Trying to force them to be something else just messes things up. He's also skeptical of the idea of real costs.
Because he thinks all costs are subjective.
Right. What something costs is always based on what you could be doing with those resources instead. And profit is the reward for figuring out what people want and giving it to them.
He challenges the idea that profit is somehow unearned.
He does. He sees profit as an essential part of the market process. It tells businesses they're on the right track. And he argues that trying to run an economy with non-market prices is a recipe for disaster.
So it leads to shortages, surpluses, basically chaos.
Exactly. The market, with all its flaws, is still the best way we have to figure out how to use resources efficiently. So to wrap it all up, Mises shows us that prices are way more than just numbers. They're complex signals that tell us a lot about how society values things.
And they're shaped by so many factors, not just supply and demand. Things like trust and reputation, which Mises calls goodwill, play a huge role.
Monopoly power can distort those signals, but in a free market, prices generally reflect what people are willing to pay for what they want. It's a constant dance between buyers and sellers, and it affects every aspect of our lives, from the cost of groceries to the wages we earn.
And, you know, thinking about all this, it really highlights how our local choices right here in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena contribute to the bigger picture.
It's true. Where we shop, who we do business with, it all matters. And if we focus on building that local goodwill, that trust and reliability, it makes our community stronger and more resilient.
It's all connected, right?
It is. And that's something for all of us to think about. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We hope it's giving you some food for thought.
Yeah, definitely. We'll see you next time.
And don't forget to support the show at thinkandactlocally.com/donate. The link's in the show notes.